Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear the middle part of a great talk John Taylor Gatto gave 6 years ago on the real function of public schools. In the first part, Gatto began by quoting then-Chrysler chairman Lee Iacocca, who said that people who are educated more than their job demands are dangerous to the established order. Gatto saw that the crummy McJobs that are the only ones available to most Americans require almost no formal education. In the recent past, Americans could have distinguished careers as leaders of business, science, government, and the arts, with nothing more than a grammar school education. The McDonald's business empire was built almost entirely by high school dropouts. And in prosperous modern Switzerland, that's still the rule. Only one quarter of Switzerland's citizens get a high school diploma. In the early 20th century, when America had sturdy, clever, independent, generally prosperous, and mostly unschooled population, when 12 years of mandatory state-sponsored schooling was even less needed than it is today, why was the huge, cumbrous, and very expensive system of public education put into place? The answer, coming from the New York City and New York State Teacher of the Year, is surprising. A clue is when I described Americans in, say, 1909 as sturdy and independent. Then, as now, Gatto says, the country was controlled by the wealthy, powerful business and financial interests. They wanted to protect their huge investments in new factories, new business enterprises, and the financing of both. They wanted to increase their own wealth and power. They didn't want a nation of mature, independent, critical-thinking adults experienced in the ways of the world. They wanted a nation of docile, obedient workers and a nation of immature, easily manipulable consumers. Mandatory, universal, legally required, and publicly funded schooling was to be the instrument to transform the children of sturdy, independent, savvy farmers into docile, obedient, unquestioning factory workers and docile, covetous, childish, and easily manipulable consumers. Workers and consumers who depended on someone else to tell them what to do and what to buy. As an important means to this end, schools would do their best to slow or stop children's maturation, to prolong childhood for several more years, to teach and reward childish habits of mind and childish behaviors. Sidebar comment here, consider the adjective Mickey Mouse, as in the school's Mickey Mouse rules, the Mickey Mouse regulations your employer imposes on you. Childish, not suitable for adults. Mickey Mouse. Okay, back to Gatto. Mickey Mouse schooling is not imposed on children of the elite. The nation's 20 or so top private schools, Groton, Andover, and the like, make a fine education available to tomorrow's leaders and inculcate in them very different patterns of mind and behavior than hoi polloi are taught. America's rulers didn't invent the idea of molding children to their liking. They found such a system already pretty much in place in England, and very much in place in Prussia. America's rulers Americanized the process, though. They shaped children not to serve the needs of the state, as in Prussia, but to serve the needs of capital. In Part 1, Gatto introduced these ideas and discussed the contributions to the new system by a very influential theorist and professor of education, James Bryant Conant of Harvard. Today, Gatto develops these ideas further and discusses the contributions of another prominent theorist and professor of education, Alexander Inglis. Inglis discerned 6 desirable functions of public schooling, only one of which involved education, and then education only for a small minority of students. Let's listen a bit, take a break for some music, and then return to the talk.
Now let's go back to James Bryant Conant, the president of Harvard, who gave me my first clue about the actual purposes of forced schooling. In a book published in 1949 called The Child, the Parent, and the State, Conant stated flatly that that our familiar, dull schools were the result of a coup, a good coup, he thought. But he didn't analyze the coup in depth in that book. He only referred those interested to a book written in 1918 by another Harvard man, Alexander Inglis, to find out how the coup was pulled off and what it was about. Inglis was a second-string All-American from Amherst, and he had gone from there to head Houghton Mifflin's Secondary Education Publishing Division at a time when that publisher virtually controlled pedagogical publishing. If you wanted to know anything about schools past, present, or what was coming, you read books published by Houghton Mifflin or Macmillan. In that role, he was able to select what the professional public, superintendents and student teachers alike, got to read about the new school industry being born. Schooling is a surgical incision into which class-based management theories of England, to be precise, were to be subtly inserted into the collective American consciousness to interdict the liberty tradition. By infiltrating the minds of children out of the sight of their parents or any other traditional local authority, the trick would be done. Now, the well-educated will not be shocked. Theories from Plato to Rousseau to Frederick of Prussia knew and taught that if children could be kept childlike or childish beyond its term in nature, if they could be cloistered into a limited society of children, held without any real responsibility except obedience, if their inner lives could be attenuated by removing the insights of history, literature, economics, philosophy, religion, music, and art, if the imminence of death and the certainty of pain and loss in everybody's life could be removed from daily consciousness, if profound reflections on the certainty of one's own death could be replaced with the trivializing emotions of greed, envy, jealousy, and fear, young people would grow older, but they would never grow up. And if they never grew up, a great enduring problem of supervision would be solved. For who here could argue that childish and childlike people aren't easier to manage than critically trained, self-reliant ones? If you're skeptical, you want to keep in mind the words of Lee Iacocca, CEO of Chrysler, spoken out of your earshot in Argentina. Educated people are dangerous. Now you're ready to hear Alexander Inglis on the real purposes of schooling. All the categories are in his original. On some of these, I've added a little interpretation to make the meaning clear. The first function of schooling is adjustive. Schools are to establish fixed habits of reaction to authority. Notice that this precludes critical judgment completely. Notice, too, and this is a biggie, that requiring obedience to stupid orders is a much better test of whether the kid's been properly adjusted than asking him or her to follow sensible orders ever could be, because sensible people always follow sensible orders. So you've got to make sure that they've demonstrated that they've ceded their own judgment and will follow stupid orders. Recall that this list of six comes to you not from John Gatto, not from a conspiracy theory, but from James Bryant Conant's recommendation that if you wanted to understand what schools really were about, you should get a hold of Alexander Inglis's book, The Principles of Secondary Education. So the second function of schooling is the diagnostic function. School is to diagnose each student's proper social role, logging the evidence mathematically and anecdotally on cumulative records. Third comes the sorting function. School is to sort children by training individuals only so far as their likely destination in the social machine, not one step beyond. The fourth function is conformity, but put out of your mind what you think conformity means. As much as possible, kids are to be made alike, not from any passion for egalitarian ideals, but so their future behavior will be mathematically predictable in service to market and government research. Fifth comes the hygienic function, and once again, put out of your mind whatever you think is meant by the word hygiene. It has nothing here to do with health at all of the individual, but a lot to do with the health of the race, at least as Inglis, Galton, and Darwin saw it. Hygiene is a polite way of saying that school is expected to accelerate natural selection by tagging the unfit so clearly that they will drop from the reproduction sweepstakes or be so inept at parenting that their families will collapse and therefore terminate somewhat further down the line. And last of the six functions of schooling is what Inglis called the propaedutic function. That's a fancy word meaning that a small fraction of lucky kids will quietly be taught to take over management of this continuing project, guardians of a population deliberately dumbed down and rendered childlike in order that government and economic life can be managed with a minimum of hassle. Now, it's one thing to say you're going to do all those things. That was 1918. And another to actually do them. What, for instance, would the mechanism look like that could reduce people to a state where they would be compliant in such dispositions? While Britain and Germany had conditioned their own populations for centuries to accept paternalistic direction from the political state, it hadn't happened here. And a project of this magnitude could not just be rammed down citizens' throats. They would have to be taught to actually welcome it increment by increment, welcome the extension of childhood and the onset of childishness. If at any point public outrage got too loud, the scheme's managers would have to know enough to retract it a bit and wait until under cover of some national emergency, like war or depression or other civil unrest, it could be sent racing forward while people were looking elsewhere. That's how the formidable American ability to read and to argue was deconstructed under the drums and tramplings of World War II. The plans called for the infantilization of America, the gradual dumbing down, the gradual demoralization, the slow, steady removal of critical responsibilities from families and their transfer to bureaucrats. What I'm talking about is a radical extension of childhood, principally through schooling at first, but in time through every institution, including and especially popular entertainment, under the direction of a small elite which removes the necessity to entertain oneself. But once again, we need to reiterate that childishness is not an objectionable quality to management, but rather its very justification for being. Childish people are unable to offer effective resistance to management. They may whine, complain, even shoot one another, but they have no idea how things work. Childish people, for all the noise they make, are nearly helpless. Eventually, they fall back into line because they have no other choice. They lack inner resources to be self-sustaining.
I've had enough of this small town bullshit. I'm not staying in school. I'm making good dough, working with my brother, cleaning out pools. I'm going out to California, and man, it won't be long. Soon as I get my license, color me gone. I'll knock it off, Johnny. Man, you're living in your head. You ain't even got a car, and those chicks don't believe a word you said. But you're doing all the talking, so I'll just keep quiet. And this'll probably go nowhere, but I can't blame you for trying. It's just us kids in the park at night, hanging around neath the vapor light. Got no drugs and we got no guns, not even bothering anyone.
Second half of the 19th century, the North German states of Prussia, Saxony, and Hanover, a science of making young people childish grew up. It was studied by certain prominent Americans like Horace Mann or William Torrey Harris. He was the first national superintendent of schools. By the Peabody family, by J.P. Morgan, and by others who envied Prussia the control it offered to management and wanted that control themselves. With the rise of the centralized corporate economy, a quarter century after the Civil War, another overriding reason to place the population under tight management come about. I'm following the trail of the growing corporation, which oddly enough got its start right here in California in the Supreme Court case Santa Clara versus the Southern Pacific Railroad, 1886. It's the first time in human history that a corporation is given all the rights that a human being has. It's that case right here in California. Prior to that time, corporate charters lasted 20 years, sometimes a little longer. The corporation could only do what it had written in its charter, saying it could do. It couldn't conglomerate and swallow other corporations. While the liability was limited, the veil could be penetrated very easily. Corporations were never trusted from their inception to be anything other than very, very dangerous ways to make a state prosperous. But in California in 1886, all that ended, and they got the rights of human beings. Corporations were never allowed to interfere in politics in no country that had them. They could not interfere, come down on either side, let alone both, as we do here to preempt the debate. Anyway, suffice it to say, there were plenty of interests who wanted the public childish, but none had the resources of corporations to sustain a campaign in that direction. For a long time, it only required a little corporate financing done behind the scenes to allow an army of innocent academic and philosophical screwballs to do the government corporate bidding unknowingly, thinking they were riding their own hobby horses. Those of you who have ever worked in an American college or university will know this, but I do not think the general public is aware that there is no way to rise in the college university system, no way at all to even retain your job unless you can get corporate grants or foundation grants. Of course, all those foundations are corporate foundations or government grants. You must be able to bring little rivers of money in from the outside or you last a very short time in the college scene. Well, at that point, getting those grants is life and death. You don't do what you want to get those grants. You put your finger in the wind, find out where the money flow is going, what it wants you to do and say, and that's what you do and say. Now, that's a bit cynical, but I think it's better to raise the notion in your minds that way. I was personally put on the trail of radically extended childhood paid for by business and government by reading the works of Elwood Cubberley, who was a friend of Dr. Conant at Harvard, and Alexander Inglis's partner at Houghton Mifflin, where he edited the elementary school textbooks and Inglis did the secondary school. Cubberley, another California name, was dean of teacher education at Stanford. And while there, he became head of a thing that used to be called the Education Trust. It is a shadowy cabal of academics nationwide who controlled every major administrative post in America by 1918. In 1906, Cubberley wrote in his PhD thesis that in the new schools coming, the children were to be shaped and fashioned like nails, and the specifications were to come from business and government in that order. I think if you drive onto the Stanford campus, there's either a Cubberley building or there's a little statue up there to Cubberley. Specifications, of course, are terms for outcomes desired. How those outcomes were to be reached was up to the academics and bureaucrats who worked for the policy people in business that's known as managing by objectives. A few years later, in 1919, Cubberly wrote that childhood had been deliberately extended by 4 years after the Civil War because a combination of powerful interests demanded this. That's in his History of Education. The trick was pulled off by denying children association with the adult world and with real responsibility through comprehensive confinement schooling, which creates a world of children separate from the real world. There, the little human resources can be held until summoned. It isn't very hard to see that the interest most directly served by delaying personal sovereignty is something we can call the managerial outlook. Total management and human independence are mutually contradictory terms. Once professionalized, management finds it irresistible to argue that neither children nor parents can be trusted. How many times I heard that in my 30 years in the school business. That the only sensible way to handle growing up is through expert goal setting and professional interventions at public expense. It's time we all face the fact that expert management is never well served by allowing children to grow up, even to grow whole. Its tutelage is justified intellectually by the academic disciplines of psychology, sociology, anthropology, evolutionary biology, even military science, each contending in its own way that growing up is impossible for most of us. All of these disciplines grew from corporate or government underwriting at the beginning of this century or at the end of the 19th, along with the statistical techniques which lend them credibility. Somewhat over 100 years ago, the higher academic voices in America set up a litany which communicated that we would remain children forever, always in need of supervision and regulation, the identical message the Prussians had heard a century before that. One recent piece of evidence that our leaders listened to those voices came to me from a press conference held on TV by Vice President Gore's wife just before the election of 2000. In this press conference, Tipper Gore declared that 55% of the American people were mentally disturbed and in need of therapy, and any humane government would be providing that therapy at no cost. I made that last part up. I don't know if she said that. But Mrs. Gore is only one of a host of commentators urging that we be kept under closer and closer surveillance. When speaking to this question of general irresponsibility, observe how very convenient and useful it is that American classrooms are workshops of rudeness, rowdiness, and danger. How better to instruct the oncoming generations that their only hope of safety lies in expert ministrations. At the end of the 20th century, 100,000 American schoolchildren were being barcoded in an experiment to track their passages and see to it that each boy and girl is always where someone else thinks they belong. The profound change in the American bargain with its young, the change that dumbing them down and demoralizing them brought about, wasn't the result of popular demand, nor was it caused by prominent socialists like John Dewey, who are often blamed. The transformation was an undertaking of industrial titans like Andrew Carnegie, J.P. Morgan, Vincent Astor, Commodore Vanderbilt, John D. Rockefeller, Henry Ford, and a few others. The private tax-exempt foundations and elite private boarding schools of these men continue their work to this day.
New World Notes comes to you from WWUH at the University of Hartford.